Ladies and gentlemen, the red or the blue pill, the choice is yours.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damigod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
I'm here today with my beautiful friend Desiree Roefer from Holland. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly, who is a very special soul who's gone through absolute hell, I would say, in her personal life to come to the place where she is today. It has been a life experience that have gone through many different phases and at times very, very painful. But she's here today to help open the eyes of us who doesn't know so much in the areas of vaccine and what healthcare is doing and so on. So it is with great joy and an honor to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Ole. Yes, my name is Desiree Roefer. It's a German name. My background is all over Europe. I have Italian ancestors, French, Norwegian, German, and Dutch. So I'm a calico cat. my life, if I write my autobiography, that people say, don't exaggerate. But the first thing that happened in my life, that is, a doctor arrived in my life and gave me a smallpox vaccine because I was going to travel to the Dutch Indies, Indonesia today, because my father was already there. And that vaccine gave me mononucleosis, typhus, a herpes virus. So I was always sick as a child and didn't want to eat and things like that. So then when I look back at my life right now, that every time a doctor arrived in my life, a medical doctor, mainstream, educated, then all hell breaks loose. My youngest years were in Indonesia, and it's rare that people can remember so far back as I can do. I remember things from the time that I could not even walk. It's like a movie. And Indonesia, of course, is a children's Valhalla with the temperature and the climate and things like that. And I got uprooted there when I was 5 years old because my father fell ill. He had been a prisoner in a Japanese camp. And that's why he got cancer, I guess. And so he died when I was 5, and I lived with my mother in The Hague. And so that is a huge difference from the tropics into The Hague, smack in the middle of a city in an apartment building that was brand new. We were the first people to live there, and it was February, and it was awfully cold, I remember. So that were all shocks on my system and uprootings, and well, I really had to recalibrate my whole life again. And when I was 10, my mother met a man. And he lived in a tiny, tiny village in the center of Holland. And she married him. And so when I was 10, I was uprooted again from city life in The Hague to a tiny, tiny village in the Betuwe. It's the center part of Holland where they have all the fruit trees. It's beautiful. But I couldn't understand the people because they have a dialect. It's awful. So, and I was totally alone. I knew nobody, and my stepfather was a headmaster of a school. And so the whole village was watching me like, she's coming from the big city. And so I was tested left, right, and center by the boys from the school. I had to jump over water things. And of course, I fell in and they loved it. And my gosh, it was really a difficult time. Anyway, I will skip a few things, but my mother wanted me to do the gymnasium, which is a classical school with Latin and Greek and all. And I did that for her. And I'm very, very glad that I did, because I could use that knowledge, especially the Latin and Greek, when I landed into the hospital with my second son years later in 1981. And he had strange things going on. He had been saying that he didn't want to eat anymore. And all of a sudden, he couldn't walk anymore.
How old was he at that time?
2 years old and 3 months, something like that.
Oy, oy, oy.
And so you can wonder, why does a child that age get cancer? Crazy thing. I have the answer now, but... At that time, I didn't know that. So I landed into the hospital. And when in Indonesia, because of my mononucleosis, I was landed at 3 years old in the hospital myself in Indonesia. And my mother was not allowed to visit me. So I was there for a week. And if I have a movie about that, and that is the trademark of a traumatic experience, that you have this movie that you know all details, so I can describe my pajamas, and I know that I was stark raving mad being left alone in that hospital. And I had two ways to protest. It was to pee and to scream, and I did both. I remember. Anyway, that made it for me very easy to stay with my son 24/7. And the hospital in Amsterdam, they did not like that at all, of course, because I was seeing everything they did. And I stayed with him in the hospital for 3 months, and I was present at every action they did. And so I got a sort of crash course into the thinking of doctors, of medical doctors. And I remember that at the time, I often thought, this is not logical what they're doing. And you know the game where you have a table and you have a straw and a little ball and you blow the ball around on the table? Well, it felt a bit like that, their protocols or their way of thinking. I don't know. But all the time something would happen that was not okay. And so it was a really an emotional roller coaster. And I learned very fast in that hospital. It was a sort of crash course in growing up and getting to the essence of things. Because I would say to them when something had happened and I had been upset and I had thought about it and spoken about it with some people to get to the essence of the matter, I would say, this and this has happened to us. This it has done to us. And this is the solution. And because it was devoid of all emotion, what I said, that solution was always accepted. And then there came a point then that I thought, this is interesting. Maybe I can get these people to a place that I would like to have them. And then I thought, no, because then I go out of my integrity. I cannot do that. But that makes that I can recognize that point of going out of your integrity in other people. I immediately know it. And I worked with two.
Could you explain that a little more?
I worked with two Indian gurus, and they taught us beautiful things. And then all of a sudden, they would deviate from the straight part and narrow path of truth, like doing wrong things with women or money. So what else is Noah?
Oh, God.
And they knew that I knew. So they sort of, they hated me. And I would tell that to the people in the group, and they would hate me also because they were not on that point yet to recognize what this guy was doing. So I have always or often been in the position of the first one to ring the bell, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that's not a very comfortable position, as you well know, Ole. And anyway, when I was in the hospital, I had also that position. I knew from the first moment on, and don't ask me why, but the first moment I set foot in that hospital with my son, I knew that I had a trailblazing function there. So when I came there and I wanted to stay with my son day and night, they didn't give me a folding bed. I could sleep on the floor as far as they were concerned. So a friend of mine brought a garden chair that she had used in her beautician practice, and I slept on that chair for weeks on end, and eventually I got a folding bed, but things like that, you know. But today those folding beds are waiting in the hallway for parents who want to stay with their children. So it's totally opposite, but we did that, my son and I. And so it's often that children in a situation like that, they grow up very fast and they turn out to be very wise souls. And together we changed a lot of things in that hospital. And 8 years after he died from the chemotherapy, I went back to the hospital because there was someone who had invited Jerry Jampolsky, an American psychiatrist, to come to the Netherlands. And this psychiatrist had a present for children in Holland with cancer. He had an invitation for them to go to Disney World. And the guy who asked Jerry to come didn't know what to do and how to deal with that. And I said, well, I do. So I called the hospital again. I called the oncologist and I explained. And 2 weeks later, we were all in one room, all the people that I knew from 8 years before when my son was still alive. And all these hospital people were very uncomfortable because now there was an American going to tell them how to do things. Oh, but Jerry sort of bumped into a chair and said, hi guys, how do you do things around here? And then they started to tell stories. And every while again, they had to look at me because they were talking about something that I had begun to change in that hospital. But the best thing I heard that day was when the head nurse, who was very tunnel visioned when I came in that hospital, she said, I have learned to listen to the children. And I thought, whoa, that's a godsend.
Desiree, I know this is very personal, but would you mind talking a little bit about the time when your son passed and so on, and how you went through this whole, I know there's a lot of parents out there going through very difficult times, and maybe there's ways for you to advise or support them in how to deal with these horrific events.
It was very clear for me that I was keeping the sacred space for him. And I'm getting a bit emotional because the 3rd of April is the day he died. Sorry. I can explain, it never stops being painful. You can handle it. You can work on it to talk about it as I just did, like matter-of-factly, but there will always be a moment that something comes in and then poof, you are there again. But parents need to stay with their intuition because they know their child. They know what's good for him. And most hospitals still, and most doctors still, are educated to do their protocols. And the patient is sort of, well, a subject that's accidentally there or so. It's seldom that it's the other way around, that the hospital is there for the patient or the child. And maybe it has changed, but I have seen one night I was there in the hospital with my son, and in the booth next to us, there was a little baby with spina bifida, a backside that didn't grow closed. And all of a sudden, six students came in with white coats, and that baby started to scream. So I went to them and I said, I don't know what you're doing here, but this is not the way. I protect this child from you right now. So out you go. And they went. They were sort of, whoa, what's this? But my intuition told me that this was a traumatic experience for that child. And I couldn't let that happen, because if I did, you know, changing the world by not doing anything, come on, it doesn't work that way. And there's one story that is funny to tell, although it was not funny at the time. They do a lot of tests in between when you have a child with cancer in the hospital. And once they did another test with his kidneys, with contrast fluid on the x-ray, and the guy who took the photo was not allowed to say anything about what was on the photo, but he was supposed to tell me that the photo itself had succeeded. It was okay. But what he did was, he said, there is something wrong. Well, when you say that to a mother who has been going through an ordeal of two operations and all the sort of radiation crap that they do, then it was like the ground opened under my feet, and the world sounded like there was cotton wool between me and the rest. And I got icicled. Now I know it is that they shatter your aura. So all protection in the world is gone. And I was livid afterwards, of course. And I told the oncologist what had happened. And he said to me, he should never have said that. He was not allowed to say that. And I said, I want to speak to this guy. And he saw, the oncologist knew that I am an Aries with a lot of fire. So he thought, uh-oh. And I never knew up front what I was going to say or do to this guy. But I met him in the corridor, and he was an American, and it made it easy. Because in English, you can say things more easily sometimes. And I went up to him and with my fiery eyes. And he was sort of taken aback. And I said to him, I stood right in front of him and I said, you owe me one here and one here. He was flabbergasted. But it came up like an intuition that I had to do something with him that he wouldn't count on. He wouldn't understand, but he would never forget.
Mm.
So, yeah. That's what I did. And they laughed their heads off in the hospital, all the doctors afterwards. But these things are important, and you have to know that. And stick with your child no matter what. Don't let doctors do anything, because everything doctors do with a little kid in the hospital is traumatic. Everything. And I had this little saying with my son. I said, getting better does hurt, but we do it together. And because of who I was invited by the professor pediatrics in that hospital, it was an academic hospital, to explain to his fourth year medical students how it is to be a mother in a hospital with a kid with cancer. And this guy, he proposed to me all sorts of ideas, a whole hour long, and I had to correct all his ideas during the whole hour. And then I thought, would there be students in the audience that sort of scratch their behind their ears and think, what about the rest of the information that this guy is presenting to us? But then again, I knew that students never get the time. And when they are doctor in hospital in the last 2 years of their studies, then they never, ever get the time nor the space to ask these questions or follow up, do any follow up on them. Because what I have seen, and I have checked that with all the doctors all over the world that I have spoken to in my own radio and television show, I asked them, do you agree with me that a medical education is a mind control program with sleep deprivation, lousy food, and stress on steroids? And they all say, yes.
Wow.
And then I have seen that living in the hospital, how many hours these guys and girls had to work. And then, of course, things go wrong. So with one of the, with one of the chemotherapy infusions, it leaked. And then that poison, which is incredible poison, it ruined the cells on his feet, on his foot, around the syringe, around the intravenous needle. So for months, he had a huge wound on his foot. And
imagine what it's doing on the inside then.
Yeah, exactly. And the way Philippe died was because his heart gave out. And they call one of the chemotherapeutica that he got is adriamycin. And that is a red fluid. And they call it the red death. And that's what I saw happen in front of my eyes.
I don't understand, please. What red fluid?
The red fluid is the adriamycin. It's the chemotherapeuticum.
Okay.
It's the stuff that they inject into your veins when you have cancer. And they call it a red death because it creates cardiomyopathy. So your heart blows up. Poof. And I have seen that happen with him. But I've always also seen that he was, the last hours in his life, my son was very restless. He was moving, he was fighting, he was screaming sometimes. He must have had awful pains. And then all of a sudden, he got very calm and he got very large eyes. He was looking at something that I couldn't see, but that I had sort of arranged the first day in hospital when the first time the word cancer was used. Because in my mind, I had arranged my son's funeral. And I had said to my father, you be there if this little guy has to leave this earth. And I have seen that they connected. And that was the moment that my son got calm And it was also the first time that I did not go into the hospital room of the intensive care where they wheeled him into, because in my heart I already knew he was gone. And that is something that I only understood afterwards, because with everything they did, I was there.
Your father had already passed?
Yeah, my father had passed when I was 5, so I told him, you'll be there, old man.
And can I just say that what you just described sounds a lot like when my father passed.
Mm.
Same kind of thing, that he was seeing something else, something beautiful. He calmed down and was totally calm at that time. And
There is a beautiful book by Anita Morjani. It's called Dying to Be Me.
Is she the woman that got this incredible cancer and died?
Yeah. And she came back, and she came back. But she came back with the story of what she had experienced while clinically dead.
Would you mind describing what happened to her with the disease and then?
Yeah. She lived in Hong Kong, and you have many cultures there. And for one reason, she always felt that she wasn't good enough with the English and she wasn't good enough with the other people. But she stayed with her own truth, because her father was trying to marry her to all sorts of men that he thought were good for her. But she didn't want to do that, and she married a man that she had chosen herself, because they were on the same wavelength and they were very happy. And then all of a sudden she discovered that she had cancer, and then she went to India to work in the non-mainstream way, because she had seen how the brother of her husband and a friend had been treated for cancer and died in a very short time. So she thought that's not the way to do it. But anyway, the Ayurvedic practices didn't really work with her. So at a certain moment, she was so full of cancer cells that her organs started to stop working one after the other. And she landed into a mainstream hospital with her mother next to her and her husband. And then she saw herself above the lying on the bed, and she was somewhere above that. And then she was whisked away to where her brother-in-law, who had died from cancer, and her friend were. And she saw two radiant beings, happy, healthy, beautiful. And she spoke with them, and she found out they were very happy, and it was all perfect there. And they took her with them and showed her around. And then she had the inkling, all of a sudden, the inner knowing that on a soul level, you are always whole. And she knew that she could not leave her husband and her mother behind. So she had to come back, and she did. And the strangest things happened, because it turned out that when she came back, there was no cancer anymore. And the doctors were flabbergasted and kept probing and looking and investigating. No cancer.
She was clinically dead for a while, wasn't she? Quite a long time.
Yeah. So that is her experience, and it's not the only experience. I have heard it from different people, and our minds always want to an explanation. So I compare it to a train station where you can change routes with your train. I think we have different probabilities in life, and she went to another probability, one without cancer. And because she had to tell this story to the world.
Mm.
And it's a very moving story. And you can find her on the internet, Anita Morjani, M-O-O Rjani.
I have a friend who's met her in Hong Kong, and but I think this is the beauty of these very hard experiences that we go through, because in my way of seeing it, Felipe was is the one who empowered you to do what you are doing, and
absolutely.
So with his young little body and going through what he did, he's helping thousands to. So it's these awful things, I call it boot camp, where you go through horror and horror and horror, but to form yourself and follow, if that is your strength, if you're strong enough to follow the reason why you're alive, and they will show you.
Well, I had to have discovered in that hospital during all those months that I was there 24/7 that it is true when they say you don't get to bear more than you can. But also I learned very early that no matter how black the situation is, there is always a pearl to be found. And it's Khalil Gibran who says it beautifully, the deeper that sorrow carves through your being, the higher the summits of your joy will be. Like the cypress tree, you know, it's up there like a pencil, but it's as deep as it's tall into the earth. And these things help when you're in that black hole. And I kept saying the word crash course. It's crash course in high living and in truth and in integrity. And I sometimes say that Philippe was my private Jesus.
Did you ever have a feeling that he was aware of it on some level while it was going on?
I don't know, but he was very intelligent and he had a huge humor. He was a great kid. When he fell ill at first, he wasn't speaking yet, really. But he had to learn fast. And he had a great sense of humor and he was a wise old soul. And I understand very well that he came to Earth to do this. And I helped him to do it as best as he could. And we changed that hospital for one. 25 years, 30 years later, after his death, I came into that same hospital to visit someone. And then you have coincidence. I stepped into the elevator and who was there but the woman who was a psychologist to be in the time that I was in the hospital. Now she was a full-fledged psychologist working in the hospital. She recognized me immediately and I recognized her. And she said, your name is still mentioned sometimes here. Mm-hmm. So of course. They can't get around us for what we have changed there. And that's fun, that's great. And I also saw that in that trailblazing function, I had to tread lightly and carefully with other parents because many other parents were not in the place of awareness that I was. So I always had to see to it that I was on their level of understanding when I was talking to them, because otherwise you can wound people very deeply.
I know you were at the Open Mind conference in Denmark. We met in Holland at the Open Mind as well, and one thing that you said once that really sort of hit me was that if I remember right, that as far as you know, nobody without having been vaccinated have had cancer.
Yeah. I have a book by Morris Beale. It's a book from 1949. And in there, he has a quote from a doctor who says, and a doctor was in the first half of the 1900s, I think. That doctor says, I have seen 200 patients with cancer, and I have never seen cancer in a non-vaccinated person. And yes, vaccines have foreign proteins. They have genetic information from other species, and that all gets injected into your bloodstream. They inject it into a muscle, yeah, but it comes into your bloodstream eventually. And there it creates havoc. Plus that one of the vaccines, polio vaccines, the Sabin and Salk vaccines of the 1954 or so, that time, they were contaminated with cells from the monkey kidney tissues on which they were cultured. That is SV40, simian 40 virus, meaning it is the fourthiest monkey virus that they found, but this virus did not die or get neutral with formaldehyde or heat or whatever process they use to purify the vaccine. So today, in the brain tumors of adult Americans, the exact SV40 strains are being found from the vaccines they got 6 years earlier. So when do you have an adverse event from a vaccine, from second number one to 60 plus years afterwards?
You know, another speaker and a close friend of mine is Judith Very Baker, who is the girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald, the man accused of killing JFK. And she was recruited by the CIA because she had one of the highest IQ in the state of Florida. And she was doing, because her grandmother died of cancer, or her aunt, she was doing experiments at home trying to find a cure, and she found ways of getting cancer to grow faster than anyone else at that time.
Mm-hmm.
She did it to find a cure for it, but without knowing it, she was being recruited by the CIA, who had found this SV40 virus because it was so, what do you call it, viral, so aggressive.
Yeah.
And they've never seen anything like it. So they wanted to turn it into a bioweapon and use it against the Fidel Castro. But it was Alton Ochsner, the Judith Berry Baker's boss at the hospital in New Orleans, in Louisiana, who were part of spreading the polio virus, polio vaccine in the States. And just a week or two, this is late 50s, early 60s,
yeah,
before they were going to go out live with this. I mean, they ended up injecting more than 200 million Americans and many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands in Europe as well. There was a female colleague of this Alton Ochsner that found this live virus in the vaccines. And she was like, she went out and said, oh my God, we need to stop it. This is awful. This is cancer causing.
Beatrice Eddy. Yeah.
And she, Alton Ochsner, then said more or less, shut up, and destroyed her career. He went out and gathered a press conference because he couldn't, he wanted to stop sort of like scandal. And he said, everything is okay, not a problem at all. And he injected his two grandchildren, and one of them died within 24 hours, and the granddaughter developed severe polio for the rest of was handicapped for the rest of her life, and still they went on and injected it.
Yeah.
And even though they knew that they had injected this live cancer-causing virus into so many millions of, they kept doing it for years and years until the vaccines ran out.
Yeah.
And this is, according to Judith and other researchers, what we're seeing now, this global epidemic of cancer, is the cause came from there.
Absolutely. Leonard Horowitz writes about this, and he found a radio show that had not been aired, I think, but I have the MP3 of it, where they make jokes about this vaccine, this polio vaccine. The CEO of Merck, Hilleman, makes a joke. He says they had sold many of these millions of the polio vaccines already to the USSR. So the joke in the lab was, the next Olympics, we are going to win because the Russians come to the Olympics loaded with tumors. And then the people in his company are laughing.
I mean, what can you say? What type of mentality? But this is very important to see that this is the mentality behind these forces that are doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are totally psychopathic. Mm. No empathy. But as I said, doctors are being trained to lose their empathy. Mm. As I said, that the guys who walked into the room of the baby next to me, they just did. Never thinking about the position of the baby. What would she find? What would she think? Never. And even so, this summer I broke my wrist. I went to a plastic surgeon in an academic hospital. And this woman said, yeah, it's not totally okay because the bones, the two bones in my arm, the tops are not at the same place anymore, at the same height. So you will have loss of function. But, well, with your age, and I must have looked like I smelled, I don't know what, but she said, oh, but I don't think you will agree with that. I said, no, I don't think so.
Are you like 98 or something like that?
Yeah, something.
In that case, you're doing really well, I must say.
Yeah. No, I'm going to be 69 next week.
But Leonard Horowitz, I think, is a fantastic human being that has been part of exposing a lot of incredible things.
Absolutely.
And just going face to face with these people that have been part mm-hmm. of. One of the things he's made several different documentaries. One of them is called In Lies We Trust, which I think is a fantastic title, where he exposes how the AIDS virus was created, ordered, and created in laboratories in the U.S. Under Robert Gall, I think is the name of the doctor is.
Yeah. Gallo.
And he even approaches him at a press conference and totally confronts him with the facts. And you can see how Robert Gallo is like, his whole body is trying to get away. And look at the eyes of this man while you're talking. I mean, but very, very important documentary to watch, I would say. In Lies We Trust.
Yeah. Well, I have had an experience a couple of years ago. I wrote a book on the HPV vaccines for so-called cervical cancer risk and that sort of crap. The authorities in Holland were not amused because there was a, how you say that? They had a program for girls from 13 to 16 years old, and they called it a catch-up campaign. Like, we have to get as many future mothers and inject them with this crap. By the way, interesting is I found that cervical cancer is a risk in the third world countries. And where did they vaccinate first, big time?
Third world countries.
No.
No, they did.
The Western countries, just the opposite.
But the third world countries are often the ones that get vaccines that have been expired and is no longer...
Yeah, but with the HPV vaccines, it doesn't matter. It's murderous material anyway. But I wanted to say something about it. But there's so much to say about the HPV vaccine. When I published my book, they raked me over the coals. How you say that? Something like that. I was a witch, and I was this, and I was that, and the other. But all the predictions that I very, in the form of questions, have in that book, everything has become reality. And I know, I can't prove it, but I know that the HPV vaccines are a sterilization campaign. There are girls that have not even menstruated and landed, boom, into menopause. Something else very important that I discovered is they say that the HPVs are the cause of cervical cancer. But what happened, what I found out when I was doing the research for my book, is that in 2006, Merck was the first to win the race with Gardasil. They dug up a Professor Zurhause, and this guy had been fluttering around in cervical cancers, and he had found sometimes HPVs. And this guy, who was doing this research in the 80s, all of a sudden got a half Nobel Prize in 2008 or something. And I thought, what's that? And then I found a book, I have it here, and that talks about, it's drug-induced nutrient depletion handbook, meaning that when you have medication, you will lose precious nutrients, vitamins, minerals, that sort of stuff. What do I see that the contraception pill robs your body of? Folic acid, vitamin C, vitamin, all the B vitamins, selenium, magnesium, CoQ10, a whole lot of stuff. But if the body doesn't have enough folic acid, then the cervix doesn't have what it takes to be healthy. So there come lesions, damage into the cervix. Then, and that's how my mind works, I think, what did I read that Rudolf Virchow once said, a doctor at the end of the 1800s, begin 1900s, I think. He discovered that pathogens have a preference for sick tissue. Bingo. So my conclusion is, if you find HPVs in the cervix, that means that the tissue is not healthy, and that might be because there is not enough folic acid. So if you give supplementation with folic acid and all the other vitamins and stuff, then it will heal, the HPVs will be gone. So HPVs are a signal of a nutritional deficiency, not the cause of cancer.
I think to understand the area we're getting into here is you need to start and study the mentality behind the so-called New World Order and how the forces behind the veils are pulling the strings in a direction that is very dark for humanity.
Absolutely.
And also where they're using many different weapons against us. And one of these weapons, I would humbly suggest, is the vaccines that are there being called, said that, it's for your protection. They love that one. It's for your protection. It's because we care about you. But I've had from insiders and the way I, not that I'm an expert in this field, but I've certainly done everything I can to expose about vaccines. We never vaccinated our children at all, and they're super healthy and so on. But the information I got from the inside is that vaccines are weapons of mass destruction.
Absolutely.
What would your comment be to that?
It's true, yeah, because if you vaccinate a person at the beginning of life, you create a lifelong patient because you upset the immune system. When you have doctors and authorities in vaccination land, they all went to the same universities. They all learned the same crap. A university, unus in Latin is one. Virto, vertere, is to turn to turn. So university means put the noses all in one direction. The wrong direction, I know. Because I have proof that from what I experienced in that hospital, doctors know nothing about health. They know everything about medication because it's called study medicines. They know nothing about food, and food is what builds our bodies, what maintains our bodies, what can repair our bodies. There is a beautiful series. Everybody should look at that because it blows the Western medical patent crap out of the water. And that's the series Betrayal. And that is about how to reverse autoimmune diseases, because vaccines will cause autoimmune diseases, period. With vaccination, we have exchanged easy to treat infectious diseases with complicated chronic autoimmune diseases. That's what we have done. And the fact that people are ingrained, are hypnotized with vaccines are safe and effective, that makes when I say vaccines are dangerous, don't do it, that I meet immediately resistance, cognitive dissonance, and especially with doctors and authorities, because after I published my book, I was invited by a think tank in Holland. I always call them the Tavistock Institute, but they are called the Rathenau Institute, but there's little difference, I think. And all these guys and gals from the institutes that propagate the vaccines and that make the vaccines and that, I don't know, and Western medicine, they all came together to talk about what I had said, that HPV vaccination is not such a good idea. By the way, that campaign for the girls 13 to 16 years old, it's my fault that didn't go well because I think less than 50% of the girls came to get the vaccines. So yeah, I must have done something right.
Can I ask you, some people that listen to this and who is very much into sort of mainstream health and mainstream hospitals and so on, might think that you are angry and bitter because you lost your son and now you're doing this to get revenge and so on. But what have your studies over the year, what has that given you, or what would you say to answer these accusations? I'm sure you've heard them before.
Yeah. And my personality, like in areas, is not helping there because I'm rather fiery, but yeah, for some people that's too much. No, I don't, I'm not bitter in that sense. What I'm bitter about is that not what I'm not bitter about, maybe I could cry about what my research discovers. That's what it is. So I'm sometimes very impatient in that I want people to wake up, that the only way that the body can heal is when you use substances that the body knows, which is food. And then you can extract things from that food, like supplement vitamin B or whatever, or an injection vitamin B12, I don't know. But use substances that the body can work with, because medication is, even in the language, it's always war against the body. Beta blockers, cholesterol inhibitors, that sort of thing, you know, antibiotics. You have to work with the body to help it, to give it the materials so that the self-healing mechanism can work again. Because the body knows. I mean, when you have a scratch, you don't think about making a little protection on top of it. Your body does that. And that wisdom we have to use.
I think this is the whole key to everything, isn't it? To look the beauty and perfection of nature and the whole way, if we don't mess it up, is there to extreme perfection. And whatever I learn is like, all, if you don't know the solution, look at nature. It shows you it was good before we messed it up. And the same with our health and so on. The immune system is this magical entity. I don't even know what to call it, but it's sort of like it will solve. It solves everything if we can just let it. And just like you say, when you get sick, the idea I would suggest, not being a doctor, but I would suggest is to do everything to make sure that the immune system is working, and then leave it to the immune system. But is it correct that these autoimmune diseases, that is the body's way, because you have taken foreign things from outside the body and injected into the system so that the body cannot defend itself? It's trying to get rid of it because it's not part of the body. And so it's constantly struggling with these things that have been injected into it. So it's on constant war mode.
Yeah, exactly. And then it gets tired and then you get really sick. But you can turn those things around, and by way of food. And that's what that film Betrayal is about, that documentary. BetrayalSeries.com is the website to find it. And it's amazing. There is one doctor in there, because it's all doctors telling the story, and a few people who had the problem also. But these doctors explain how they woke up to the fact that mainstream medicine is not healing anything. And there was this one doctor who had multiple sclerosis. And she started studying in her literature ways to get better, to get rid of the multiples of the MS. And she did that for 7 years, and she got worse and worse and worse and worse. And in the end, she could only lie in a wheelchair, period, nothing. In the film, she is just like you and me, sitting straight and telling the story, because she had a friend who said once to her, try a different direction. Go look in a different way at what you're having. And then she discovered functional medicine. And functional medicine is created by Jeffrey Bland, whom I met 10 times in Brussels. He came every year to give a course. And functional medicine looks at what processes in the body are not able to do their job. What do these processes need in terms of substances, food substances, vitamins, minerals, that sort of thing. And when you give these substances, then the self-healing mechanism can kick into gear again. And so this MS doctor, a doctor with MS, who couldn't do anything anymore, She healed herself completely. She reversed her MS completely.
Wow. Wow. Listen, Desiree, we're coming to the end of the first hour, and I really, really want to thank you for taking the time. Is there any way, or what would you like to say to help people in difficult situation? And is there, how can people reach you? And is there any way we can support you in what you are trying to accomplish?
Well, I used to have a website, but I have not at the moment. I have a Facebook page, Desiree Rover. And yeah, people can reach me through there. And there are on the internet several films of my videos of my presentations about vaccines, chemtrails, and other things. And of course, doing what I do, mainstream people don't like me very much. And so I am told that there is a lot of nasty things about me said on the internet, but I have no clue because I don't read it. These people don't know me, so I don't care. I know where I'm coming from. And yes, I'm a fiery person, and for some people that is difficult, but for me, it's very clear that I come from a place of love.
Your heart is very obvious. It's very surrounding you. Listen, Desiree, thank you so much, and I'll see you in part 2.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.